Continuing our study in Nehemiah, and I mentioned last week that I had gathered some slides together that I wanted to go with you. So I'm going to, well, no, I won't because I want to record this, but we'll just talk about it from here. This is a map of the route that Nehemiah took. I think you might have seen this one already, but I like the way it looked. So you can see that Susa is here, and that this would be the route that they would take, which, as you see down here, is what, 600 or more miles, 600-800 miles. This is the Jerusalem. I just want to lay out the foundation here. You can see that the city of David is this portion, and then the Solomon did this portion, and then Hezekiah, when he was working, he did this portion. So this is basically what Jerusalem looked like before Babylon destroyed it. And so there's some question, because you can see the smaller portion here, and you can see the bigger portion here. And so some people say that this is the wall that Nehemiah built, that it's basically the original Solomon and David portion of Jerusalem. And so this is what some people think. Of course, that's much smaller. You can see the scale of miles is one-tenth of a mile, for about, what would you say, maybe an inch. So if you went around, it might be a mile, mile and a half. And this is another one that shows the various gates that they were having to rehang the wooden gates on. This is the second assumption or possibility of what Nehemiah built, and you can see that it's quite a bit bigger than, because the other one kind of went like this. So this is quite a bit bigger, and some of them say this is what he rebuilt. And here's another example of what Nehemiah might have rebuilt while he was working. And this is Jerusalem in the New Testament. So this is Jerusalem. I figured you might like to see the comparison, that this is the Jerusalem that Jesus knew. And you can see the temple, I believe, is that the temple there? So they've changed it quite a bit. They've broadened it out this way and this way and narrowed it the other way. Another one. And then this is what Jerusalem looks like today. This one is what Jerusalem looks like today. So, and then the only other thing I wanted you to notice is the wall. This is what the walls look like. This is the kind of stone that they had to deal with. And, of course, this has been rebuilt in the Middle Ages, but it's pretty much the same basic stone that they would be using to build this temple. You can see that some of them are really big at the bottom and some of them get smaller. And some of them aren't square. I'll get to another one here. Here's another example of a wall and a gate. And then this is the actual wall, I guess, that was in the first century and probably went back to the days of Nehemiah. So you get a sense here. They're just kind of piling round rocks on one another and then probably mud in between. And here's another example. So again, just giving you some idea of what they were doing as they were rebuilding the wall. Some of the stones look like that and some of them look like that. So, and again, this is basically what Jerusalem looks like today. So I was intrigued with it. I figured if I was intrigued with it, you'd all be intrigued with it too. I hope you were. Johnny?
Yeah, is that a sandstone or something harder?
I've always thought it was granite.
Yeah.
Granite or marble.
Yeah.
I think that's what they built the temple out of. Now, whether the walls were built out of that, but I don't think it was sandstone, although some of that stuff looked pretty rough, didn't it?
Much harder than sandstone.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
Well, oh, you've been there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, you weren't intrigued then, were you? You've already seen all that. Okay.
One of the earlier slides showed the wall and then a bunch of rubble, or was that houses just in front of it? You'd have to go back about 8 or 9.
That looked like that was the old wall.
I don't even know if it's worth going back for. Let's just quickly go back. You tell me when you see it.
Back. That one, well, is now. There was another shot that looks like rubble. Oh, is that a cemetery?
It looks kind of like a cemetery, but this is rubble. I think this is, well, I don't know. It looks like this is on the inside of the city, but I'm not sure.
Well, the trees out there.
Could be.
But it was back a few more. Back a few more.
Okay.
Not that. Keep going.
All right.
It looks like you're going forward.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going back as fast as I can.
Yeah, one forward from there.
Okay, well, that's...
Yeah, one forward from there.
All right.
Okay,
there you go.
Now, so same which side of the wall are we on?
I don't know. You got buildings on this side and this side. I would suspect this is the inside.
Okay.
Because of the smaller and the huge buildings there, yeah. I don't think would be contained inside of the temple area.
That's the new Jerusalem.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
So those structures I see aren't like big houses there.
Well, I don't know. They might be. I mean, that's clearly a house. I don't know.
That's why I was asking. Okay.
I shouldn't have brought it up.
Extra question.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. All right, so he's taking these stones. Who knocked them all down? Okay, the Babylonians tore the whole, all the walls down. They tore the temple down. Ezra, Zerubbabel, Haggai, when they came back, what did they rebuild?
Their houses.
Well, their houses, but what were they supposed to be rebuilding? The temple. And so the rubble of the temple, but did they build the same temple? What were the people crying for? Okay, because it was much smaller than the temple that Solomon had actually built. So, and maybe the wall was the same. It only took them 52 days to rebuild it, so it couldn't have been a very massive project, although I will talk about that when we get there. All right, so what we've seen up to this point is that the nations that are surrounding Jerusalem don't want this wall to be built. And so they have tried various ways to, they've threatened them. First they mock them, and then they threatened them that we're going to come in and kill you all if you keep building the wall. And then now we have an internal problem. And the internal problem is dealt with the way Israel usually deals with problems. They were murmuring and complaining. Instead of coming to Nehemiah as the governor and saying, look, we've got some problems here we'd like you to deal with, the wall is being threatened with not being built because they want some food. So they grumble. You can see the very first verse there right under internal problems. There was a great outcry of the people and their wives against their Jewish brethren. There were those who said, we, our sons and daughters, are many. Therefore, let us get grain that we may eat and live. So what's the problem? Are they hungry? Is hunger a pretty powerful motivation and problem? So, and not sure why Nehemiah wasn't aware of this, but he was not aware of the condition that the previous governor had left things in. And as I said, Ezra's gone, and we've got some new corrupt leader who is allowing these things to go on. And so we look at the five things that they're murmuring about. First, we've mortgaged our lands and vineyards and houses to buy grain because of the famine. So they've mortgaged it. Normally, what would the law have prescribed after they mortgaged it?
Jubilee.
Okay, they'd have to wait till the Jubilee. Let me not get too far ahead of myself here. Number two, we have borrowed money for the king's taxes on our lands and vineyards. Now, is there anything wrong with the Jewish leaders allowing that to happen, borrowing money? See, the problem with their murmuring is half of it's not really wrong, and half of it is. So, number three, we are forcing our sons and daughters to be slaves. Some of our daughters have been brought into slavery, and it is not in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and our vineyards. So, I like to think of this in light of church problems, which I'm sure most of you have seen. And most of the church problems today, are they coming from outside or inside?
Inside.
They're coming from inside. We don't have the situation they had in the first century and that they have here of enemies who are threatening to put them to death. But the inside problems generally start when somebody's not happy. The services are too long. There's too many songs. The preacher preaches too long. We're meeting at 7:30. We should be meeting at 7. And what happens when these people start grumbling?
Division causes
Well, they usually manage to get some followers, right? Usually manage, and then they come to the elders, or they come to the men at the business meeting. And generally speaking, is it, look, we'd like to logically and spiritually sit down and talk about this problem. Is that how it normally goes? No, they're coming in there, and they're basically doing what the people here are doing. They're grumbling and complaining and basically saying, if you don't fix this, we're leaving. Or if they have enough people, what are they going to do? We're going to take over. And has this happened?
Yes.
Yeah, think about the 50s. What happened in the 50s with buildings all over the country? You know, some people took the building, some people left. It just depended on who had the most numbers. For the most part, the institutional brethren kept the buildings, and the non-institutional brethren had to leave because that's just how it shook out. But when I read stuff like this, I like to make applications to today. And these people are grumbling about things that are scriptural, and they're grumbling about things that are unscriptural, and they're complaining about expediencies, about the way that this has been done. And some of their complaints are super legitimate, and some of them are not legitimate at all. So, and that's what I did in this section, and I don't want to spend a lot of time here or we won't get through the material, but you can look at it later. In the next verse, it lays out the numbers 1 through 5 and how they came out of it. And then I point out under that next heading, some were violations and some were not. Now, in Leviticus 25, that verse just about in the middle of the page, it says, if someone becomes poor and sells himself to you, so is that lawful? Yeah, that's lawful. You shall not compel him to serve as a slave. All right? Was that what they were doing? See, they were in violation of this. This was not what they were supposed to do. And then at the very bottom, they shall not be sold as slaves. And yet, what does it say in verse number 4 above? Our daughters have been brought into slavery. You shall not rule over them with vigor. So, and then the next verse in Ezekiel was preached to these same people while they were in Babylon, probably their fathers or maybe their grandfathers, where we are told that that the wicked man oppresses the poor and the needy, and he exacts usury. What is usury?
High interest.
Okay, now any interest. Doesn't have to be high interest. You could not put any interest on any money that that a Jew loaned to another Jew. That was considered a sin. Now, they could do it to the unbelievers. And I think that's part of the reason they're so hated in the world is what have they done for the most part over the last 2,000 years? They've gotten pretty wealthy, knowing how to use their money. And so the verse just above the bottom, if one of your brethren becomes poor and has sold some of his possessions, if, verse 28, if he is not able to have it restored to himself, then that which was sold shall remain in the hand of him who bought it until the year of Jubilee. So, does that make one of their complaints illegitimate? We've mortgaged our fields and they have them? Is that unlawful? No, that was lawful. So, Nehemiah gets angry. And I think he had to take some time to work through this. Because, first of all, would you be angry at the grumbling and complaining of the people? When you look at their complaint and you realize some of this is legitimate, that people aren't doing anything wrong. And then he's angry with the leaders or rulers or wealthy because they have done some terrible things to their brethren. So let's go ahead and turn to page 2. And it says at the very top there, how angry did he become?
Very,
very angry. And so, what do you normally do when you're very angry? Because the wrath of man does not work what?
Righteousness.
Righteousness of man. So what does he do? It says, I counted to 10 after serious thought. Okay, he gives it some time. And he wants to make sure he handles this right. Because if he doesn't handle it right, either the rulers and the nobles are going to pull out or the people are going to pull out. And if either side pulls out, that's going to make the building of the wall a lot more difficult. So, but the biggest charge that he makes is that they were exacting usury from their brethren. Now, was there any way they could defend themselves against that?
No.
No, that was a clear violation of the law. It had always been a clear violation of the law. And so, and the reality is, if you look at those next two verses underneath there, if one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty, then you shall help him. Is that what they were doing? No, they weren't helping them. They were enriching themselves off of them. And then that next verse, Deuteronomy 23:19, you shall not charge interest to your brother. Interest on money or food or anything that is lent out at interest. To a foreigner you may charge interest, but to your brother you shall not charge interest, that the Lord our God may bless you in all to which you have set your hand in the land which you are entering to possess. So this one, he's got them guilty as charged. And so he calls a great assembly at the in the middle of page 2. Calls a great assembly. And he reminds them of something. And this is interesting because God reminded the children of Israel when they came into the promised land the same thing. You were slaves where? You were slaves in Egypt. You know what it's like to be a slave, and you will not enslave your brethren. Well, he doesn't have to go back to Egypt. What does he go back to here at this great assembly? According to our ability, we have redeemed our Jewish brethren who were sold to who? All the nations. The Assyrian captivity, the Babylonian captivity. They didn't all go to Babylon. They were sold to various nations as slaves. And they had to be redeemed. He'll bring that up in a minute. Had to be redeemed. So now indeed, will you even sell your brethren? Or should they be sold to us? And how they defend themselves? They were silenced and found nothing to say. So Nehemiah fulfilled his goal. He pleased the people. He rebuked the leaders. But did the leaders have anything they could use to be angry and say, we're not going to do this? No, he chose the one area. And it's interesting because that's the one thing the people didn't complain about. If you go back and look at those five things, they never mentioned the usury. What they didn't like were the consequences of the famine and the problems that had come along. And so that's what they're complaining about. And they hit a couple that are unlawful and they hit a couple that are not. But when Nehemiah investigates it, he finds out that they've been exacting usury. And, you know, when you're going into battle, do you want a bunch of extra stuff or do you want the one thing that is going to conclude the problem? Keep it simple, right? So that's what he does. He picks the most glaring example of the issue, and he camps on that. There's no reason to camp on the rest of it. If you can prove they're sinful in one thing, did you gain your purpose? Yeah. So the rest of it's going to be resolved if he can get this thing set forth, and that's what he does. And that's what we need to do when we're dealing with false teachers and false doctrine. We shouldn't get too caught up in the minutiae. When you're dealing with a false doctrine, if you can get one verse that just crushes it, which is the verse you want to use? Just use that one. Use that one. And then, of course, when the guy starts twisting and turning, then you go to the minutiae. You go to the little things that prove that that verse means what it means. Okay, so his solution to this problem is given in the second to the bottom verse on page 2. He tells the people, what you're doing is not good. And he tells them, you should be walking in the fear of God. And then he talks about the reproach of the nations, our enemies. What you're doing is going to create great reproach. Who's one of the people who caused great reproach to God that God was very angry with? Remember? One of the kings? David. That's right. It was David. He said, you brought great opportunity for the enemies of God to blaspheme God because of what you have done. And this is what we talk about when we talk about bringing shame and reproach upon the church. You have to be very careful that you are when in public, when you're doing things that other people can see. What can you do? You could bring reproach on the church and really cause problems. And that's what Nehemiah is hitting on here. And then He says in verse 10, I with my brethren and my servants am lending them money and grain. Please let us stop this usury. Restore to them even this day their lands, their vineyards, their olive groves and their houses, and also a hundredth of the money and the grain, the new wine and the oil that you have charged them. Now remember, what position does Nehemiah have? He's governor, right? Does he have the power to enforce this? So he's going to solve the problem. And what do they say in verse 12? We'll restore it. We'll require nothing from them. We will do as you say. So his authority and hopefully their conscience. Hopefully they're feeling bad about this because they've really done a terrible thing. Virgil?
This is a good example of true repentance. You can say, I'm sorry, but if you do not restore what you've taken
right.
unlawfully or harmed to the, restore to the best of your ability, you have not repented.
Right. Carl?
I read somewhere recently that I'm sorry is the most abused phrase in this country. Everybody says it, but they don't mean it.
Right, and that's where it's abused. If it's not, if it's a sincere apology, can it ever be abused? No. But, yeah, you're right. A lot of people just want to solve the problem by saying, I'm sorry, and then they're not sorry. And you can tell they're not sorry by what happens next. And Virgil's exactly right. The fruits of repentance require that you give up whatever it is that you gained that you don't have the right to have. And this is an argument I make all the time in Malawi because they've been told that once you're baptized, you can keep your wife or your wives. It's just fine. God's cleaned it all up. And I said, well, what if I were to go out and steal your bicycle tomorrow, run down, get baptized, and then tell you I get to keep your bicycle? And they just laugh. And they say, well, if I steal a woman that I can't have because God says I can't have her and I get baptized, can I say I get to keep her now? And, of course, the obvious answer is no. And this created a firestorm over there because there were several older preachers that had wives that they didn't have the right to that I didn't even know about, and they just wouldn't let them preach for me. So it was kind of an interesting situation because they didn't know what to do. When I gave them that illustration, they ran with it. It was kind of interesting what happened next. Okay, so we find in that last verse, even the priests are guilty. And, you know, we saw this with the priests in Egypt. You remember when that famine came and Joseph exacted tribute from everyone else? Who couldn't he touch? When it was time to sell their land, who didn't have to sell their land? Because the Pharaoh was giving them their money. See, it was all the priests. So they became very wealthy during that time. And the same thing is true here. These priests are going to get the tithe and they're going to get the sacrifices, and so they're going to be pretty well insulated from this, because even though the poor people aren't able to do these things, what are the rich people still doing? See, they're still giving sacrifices. So he requires an oath from the priests that they would do according to the promise. So they too have been loaning out money at interest, and they too have been buying people's lands and more and using that to enrich themselves. And so, verse 13, I shook out the fold of my garment, and I said, so God may do to each man from his house and from his poverty who does not perform this promise. And then, what does all the assembly say? Amen. That's all fine with them. The rich are saying it because they have to, and the poor are saying it because they're very excited. But it is said. And then all the people did according to the promise. So then I think the Holy Spirit, you see this compliment here. Most people don't think Nehemiah even wrote the book, but he speaks in the first person because that's what most people think, that Ezra is the guy who wrote the book, but he writes the book with Nehemiah as the one who's doing the speaking. So I think the Holy Spirit put this in here. I don't think that Nehemiah, because what does the scripture say? Let another praise thee and not your own lips.
Yeah.
That's a tough verse, isn't it?
Yeah.
Most people never praise me as much as I think I should get, so I'm going to help them out, right? I mean, that's how we think sometimes. But we have that command in there, and it's a good one. Don't praise yourself. Don't praise yourself. So Nehemiah, I don't think, is praising himself here, but it says in that verse, very top of page 3, from the time I was appointed to be their governor, from the 20th year until the 32nd year, so what's 32 minus 20? 12 years, so that's how long he's the governor. Now, the reason I point that out is because something interesting is going to be said at the very end here that I want you to think about. It says, neither I nor my brothers ate of the provisions that he could have taxed the people to get. It says, verse 15, the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people, took from them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Yes, even their servants bore rule over the people, but I did not do so. So the oppression, you see the oppression here. These governors are coming in, and what are they letting their servants do? It's kind of like the publicans in the time of Rome. What did the publicans have license to do by Rome?
Take what they want.
Take what they want. And the people had no recourse. And that's what was happening here until Nehemiah came along. He said, I didn't do that. Matter of fact, I went far beyond that. But then, look at verse 16. I also continued the work on this wall. Now, wait a minute. The wall is going to be finished in 52 days. So how could he be continuing to work on the wall? Well, clearly, they finished protecting the city. But was the wall really as complete as it ought to be? No, in 52 days they were able to build it high enough and put the gates in there so that it could be protected. But it takes him another 11 or 12 years of work on the wall. So the whole time he's there, it says, I continued the work on the wall. We did not buy any land. All my servants were gathered together for the work. What work? Work of the wall. So when Nehemiah leaves, what does that mean? The wall's done. How long did it take? 12 years. So there was a lot more to be done with those walls than the initial protection of the city. And so he stayed on and he did that. And of course, you look at those walls and you say to yourself, could that be done in 50 days by a couple thousand people? Of course, it could not. So he continued building and they got those walls really high. Okay, so now enemies go to plan B, actually plan C. We started out by mocking the Jews and trying to make them embarrassed so they wouldn't do the work. Then they tried threatening the Jews, we're going to kill you if you don't stop the work. And now we've moved to Nehemiah. So now we're going to try to stop the work with Nehemiah. So in that verse right in the middle of the page, when Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies heard that I had rebuilt the wall and that there were no breaks left in it, though at that time I had not hung the doors, then Sanballat and Geshem sent to me saying, come, let us meet together among the villages. But they thought to do me harm. So they want to assassinate him. So now what we're going to find out later is that this guy has a lot of friends in Jerusalem. He has a lot of friends because he's related to some of these people. And so they're involved in this as well. They're speaking well of Tobiah. And so, but Nehemiah sees through it. So verse 3, I sent messengers to them. I'm doing great work. I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave to go down to you? But they sent me this message 4 times. Okay, so they're motivating him. I don't know, maybe this had to do with him being governor. Maybe they were trying to get him to come down so that they could discuss some diplomatic things. Later, they're going to threaten him by telling him, you're fomenting a rebellion, and it's going to come to the king. So, and that's the next one. That verse, Nehemiah 6, 5 through 7. Now, Geshem says that you and the Jews plan to rebel. We'd love to know who Geshem is, but you can't find him in there. But he was obviously somebody important. So you have appointed prophets to proclaim there is a king in Judah. Now, if the king of king of Medo-Persia didn't know Nehemiah and that information came back to him, what would happen to Nehemiah?
Death.
He'd be put to death. But what does Nehemiah know? mean, I'm a cupbearer of the king. The king trusts me. I've been his faithful servant for many years. He's not going to believe this. He knows why I came here. So he's not too worried about it. He says in that very bottom verse, no such things as you say are being done. You invent them in your own heart. So that you're trying to make us afraid so that our hands will be weakened in the work and it will not be done. Therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. So let's go ahead now to move to page 4. So now we have a new threat. Okay, another letter comes in. They're coming to assassinate you. You need to hide in the temple. Now, the guy who does this is supposedly a prophet, and this is supposedly coming from God. Go hide in the temple. But what clue does Nehemiah have that this didn't come from God?
Because it was unlawful.
Excuse me?
Because it was unlawful.
Okay, it was unlawful. Would God command him to do something that was unlawful?
No.
No. So there's no way he can go in the temple. Who's the only people that can go in the temple?
The priests.
The priests. And there was a portion of the temple who could go in there. High priest once a year. So I can't do that. His godliness protects him here. And notice that second verse there above the wall was completed. It says, should such a man as I flee? And who is there such as I who would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. So if it came down to a choice of dying or going into the temple, what does Nehemiah say? I'd rather die. I am not going to violate the commands of my Lord. Then, and I don't know how he perceived it, maybe the next day became obvious that it wasn't true, God hadn't sent him at all. For this reason, he was hired that I should be afraid and act that way and sin so that they might have cause for an evil report that they might reproach me. Now, we've seen this last week with the Supreme Court justice. With all these false charges, what suddenly happens? Does the debate change from his convictions and how he views the law to his own personal life? And so they sought to do the same thing as here. And of course the way they did it was reprehensible when you find out that they knew about it 4 or 5 months before this, and so you can see that they were doing something very similar to this. And so if they were really wanting justice, it could have been done in a much more decent and orderly manner, and we wouldn't have come to all this big ugly mess that we've seen in this last couple of weeks. I just keep looking at it thinking a house divided against itself can't stand, and where are we now? Yeah. We're about as divided as we've ever been. And it's just ugly. And did anybody say, well, we've seen this, now we better step back? Are we stepping back?
No.
No, it's just escalating. And some people are even saying, pretty soon there's going to be a civil war. Could there be a civil war over this?
Yeah.
Sure could. Somebody starts shooting somebody and you start getting out guns, and it could get horrible. And so we need to be praying. We need to be praying about this, because this same attitude is running today. And it's just horrible to see what people are willing to do to stay in power and to accomplish what they want to accomplish. And but it all fails. Okay, the mocking fails, the threats fail, the treason fails, the threat of his life fails, and now the wall is completed. And it only takes, so all of this happened in how many days? There in verse 15, middle of the page? 52 days. So everything we've read about, the laughing, the mocking, the intrigues, the threats of death, the battles, the attempts to assassinate Nehemiah and destroy him, all in 52 days. And it only took them 52 days to get the walls up high enough to hang the gates so that now, they did hang the gates. And so when our enemies heard it, all the nations around us saw these things, they were very disheartened in their own eyes. When's the last time we read about somebody disheartened in their own eyes? There were 12 of them, actually 10 of them. Does that help?
Spies.
Remember those 12 spies? 10 of them said, we're grasshoppers in their eyes
and ours.
And in our eyes. In other words, we feel like grasshoppers too. And that's worse. Who cares what other people think about you? But if you agree with it, then you could be in real trouble. So this is not God's people. This is the enemy's. And then we read about the intrigues and the treasons and everything that's going on in that Nehemiah 6, 15 through 19, which you can read later. And then at that very last verse, when the doors were hung, he appoints some people he can trust because he just can't over. Can you oversee everything? Can one man oversee everything? No. You've got to find people you can trust and turn things over to them. You've got to be ready to turn things over because if you don't, you're just going to be overwhelmed and nothing's going to work. All right. Any other thoughts or comments before we close? Brian?
Yeah, just real quick, at that end of verses 15 and 16, it says, you know, they were disheartened in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was done by our God. So, you know, they probably had some knowledge of what God had done to those nations in the past. And, you know, in that sense, they had faith that, you know, when this God, you know, is on their side, that we're not going to be able to do much.
Yeah, and I thought about that a lot today. Is it possible God did some providential things that would have led them to that conclusion? About like Nehemiah showing up in the first place? Is that a pretty providential thing? I mean, what good luck? Well, after a while, all this good luck led them to believe what? It's not good luck at all. God's involved in this. So there was a lot going on here. I would love to have more information, but God didn't give it to us. But that's a good point. All right, we'll stop there and we'll pick up next week in chapter 7.